Chapter 7. By the next morning, Frank's condition had improved. His body temperature was back to normal, his labs remained unremarkable throughout the night, and he showed no signs of any complications from the aspiration of so much seawater. After breakfast, Maria, dumbfounded by his remarkable recovery, had reluctantly allowed him to get up and move about the habitat. But it would be a few days before he was back to full strength again. Without Frank to lead a second work team, their productivity was cut in half. Lynn decided to make the best of the situation by getting everyone involved in one project. The better part of the day was spent erecting the communications tower, one piece at a time. By sundown, the tower was fully functional, increasing their communications range and adding a full meteorological sensor package that would help them document and eventually forecast the weather. By the time they sat down to dinner, Frank was strong enough to join them. The conversation was light and cheerful, mostly good-natured teasing about Frank's and Tony's adventures in the ocean. It seemed that they were settling into a routine. As usual, Mac and Tony spent their evening on the resistance gym, while Sarah pedaled away for hours on the exercycle. Adia had become a member of the movie-watching group, along with Maria and Laura. Lynn preferred to spend her evenings reviewing the mission protocols, trying to plan ahead as much as possible. They were still missing two of their crew, and although they now had two fewer planets to survey, and therefore far more time to complete their mission, the loss of manpower and scientific expertise would make things difficult.
Day 6. We spent the better part of today preparing for our upcoming journey. Jack was quite proud of his makeshift backpack design. He used the straps from a couple of day packs and a flight seat back as a frame, then attached several small survival kit bags along either side, with one large bag down the center. With the addition of a waist belt fashioned from a few more day pack straps, the packs were ready. In fact, they were actually comfortable to wear, even with a bedroll and tent kit tied across the bottom. Despite how comfortable they felt, Jack warned that they would not feel as comfortable after a few days of lugging them through the wilderness. I managed to work a few improvements of my own into the design. I added headrest pads, which I pulled from the flight seats, along the bottom of the pack. Three pads, forming a curve, will place the pack's weight more squarely on our hips, making us able to comfortably carry even more weight. Jack was so pleased with the idea that he quickly incorporated the hip pads into his own pack. Unfortunately, we will not be able to carry everything, although Jack certainly did try. It took us several hours to settle on a packing list, and despite my protests, we were forced to sacrifice scientific capabilities in favor of the basic needs of life. Due to the weight, we have decided we must take our chances with the unknown elements detected in all the water samples taken thus far on this world. It is a risk we would have been forced to take even if we remained here, as we would eventually run out of clean water either way. After deciding on an initial walk-rest schedule of 1 hour of walking followed by 15 minutes rest, Jack has begun mapping out the first leg of our journey. We are fortunate that the first few days of our journey will be across relatively flat terrain, as we are far from having fully recovered from 4 months in microgravity.
"Has anyone seen Frank?" Lynn asked.
"Last I saw, he was headed forward," Maria answered, her eyes glued to the video screen.
"Thanks."
Lynn turned in the direction Maria indicated, wondering what Frank was up to.
"He should be resting," she thought.
It did appear that Frank was nearly back to his old self, but despite his miraculous recovery, Maria still wanted him to take it easy for a few days, just to be safe. She was worried that there might be some residual side effects due to the unknown elements in the water that he had swallowed when he had almost drowned. And those side effects could take days or even weeks to manifest themselves. Lynn made her way forward between the science and medical bays and into the passenger corridor. As she was about to head down the stairs to the lower deck, which they had nicknamed the Storm Porch, she noticed movement in the cockpit.
"Frank?"
"In here."
"What are you doing?"
she asked, as she entered the LRV's cockpit.
"Just tinkering around a little."
Frank had removed one whole panel from the aft bulkhead, where most of the radar and engineering electronics were housed.
"Shouldn't you be resting?"
"I've had enough resting," he complained. "I need something to do."
"So, you thought you'd tear apart the cockpit?"
"I was just checking out the radar gear. Thought maybe I could figure out a way to fix it."
Lynn knew what he was up to. He had refused to accept his friend's death, and although he had apparently set it aside in lieu of more immediate concerns, she knew his denial would eventually catch up to him.
"You know," Frank offered, sensing what Lynn was about to say, "when I was out there, under the water, no suit to protect me, struggling to reach the surface before my breath ran out, I felt alone."
He looked directly at her for a moment.
"I mean, really alone, Lynn. Just me against the environment."
He looked away, his gaze focused on the windows momentarily, before he resumed his work.
"I just needed something to do for a while," he explained, obviously not wanting to speak further on the subject.
Lynn watched him work for a minute, contemplating what he had felt out in the cold sea. She had never known what it felt like to be truly alone. All of her life, there had been at least 20 people within range of her voice. No one on board the Daedalus had ever been alone, short of taking a shower or using the bathroom. She tried to guess what he was thinking. He was afraid that Jack was out there somewhere, feeling as alone as Frank had felt in that water. And despite the overwhelming odds against Jack and Will having gotten out of the Icarus alive, Frank didn't want the idea of Jack's loneliness on his conscience. Frank really should have been resting, but his mind needed time to recover as well as his body. If that meant letting him tinker with the fried radar system for a little while, then that was fine. He would return to his work when he was ready. His conscience wouldn't allow him to do otherwise. Although he felt fine, Frank took advantage of another day of rest ordered by Maria to spend more time working on the radar set. The rest of the team spent the day erecting structures packed in the cargo pods, the first of which was the Ag Hut. Like the rest of the structures they were to build, the Ag Hut was a kit of carbon fiber poles and a hollow plastic shell. After assembling the carbon fiber arches and cross pieces, the hollow plastic shell was fitted over the frame and secured in place. Individual chambers within the hollow shell were filled with a special pressurized foam that would quickly cure into a hardened, porous fill that served as insulation while offering additional rigidity. Unlike other utility huts, sections of the Ag Hut's roof were covered with only a clear plastic film to allow natural sunlight into the greenhouse areas of the lab. The Ag Hut itself was divided into several sections to allow various agricultural experiments to be conducted in controlled growing environments. Within this structure, it would be Sarah's responsibility to determine which earth crops would grow in Setian soil and atmosphere, and which ones would grow in earth soil and Setian atmosphere. She would also grow crops to sustain themselves and the other colonists for the first few months of their lives on the New World, assuming they chose to settle on Tau Ceti V. They were able to assemble and skin out two additional smaller utility huts before sundown. They would outfit the huts tomorrow, giving the crew a tool shed and storage shack by the day's end. After that, they would only have the biolab, genetics lab, and two more utility huts to construct before their little encampment would be complete. After that, Mac and Tony would be able to concentrate their efforts on establishing a safe water supply and a waste recycling facility. They would not be setting up the main power plant for some time. Since the LRV would not be flight capable before the Daedalus arrived, they would simply use the reactors on the LRV as their main source of energy for the encampment. Frank had continued his work on the radar set into the late evening until Lynn had practically ordered him to turn in for the night. Despite Frank's best efforts, he and Lynn both knew that he would not be able to repair the radar set without spare parts. But Maria had advised Lynn that it was therapeutic for Frank, so she had decided to leave it alone for now.
Day 7. Early this morning, we loaded everything we could not take with us back into the escape pod and closed it up.
Jack said he wanted to protect everything in case we were forced to abandon our journey and return to camp. I was surprised, and I will admit, somewhat relieved to know that Jack was at least keeping that alternative in mind. A moment of truth came just before departure. Jack wanted to leave a note behind to direct any would-be rescuers to our course. With no other means about, I was forced to reveal the existence of my journal and allow Jack to use a blank page from the back. Surprisingly, Jack already knew about my journal, as apparently did the rest of our crew. Even more surprising was that he did not find the idea of a handwritten journal the slightest bit amusing. Jack had actually complimented the effort and said that it would undoubtedly become a significant part of Eden history in the future. I admit, I had never considered that possibility. I had always assumed it would remain a family heirloom, continuously handed down from father to son over the decades, until the thick journal was filled from cover to cover. The idea of my thoughts and feelings being scrutinized by the masses is a bit frightening, to say the least. We began our journey by following the same route we had taken a few days earlier when we went down to the river to collect water samples. It was not necessarily the most direct route, but since it was our first attempt at carrying our fully loaded packs, the route's familiarity had its advantages. Following Jack's schedule, it took us 2 rest stops to reach the river. It took us half that time previously without the packs. Jack surmised that the river would run downhill and lead us out of the valley and into the flatlands at the base of the hills. After a 3rd rest break, we followed the river's banks like a trail map, all the way down. After stopping for lunch at the base, we struck out due west across the open plains. Our progress was slowed slightly by the tall grass until we came across a migratory path that had probably been stamped out by some yet-to-be-seen large animals. As we hiked across the plain, it seemed as if the mountains completely surrounded us. Ahead of us in the distance, there were more hills with higher mountain ridges on either side. Based on the orbital scans, Jack is confident that our best course lies across those hills, then between the 2 mountain peaks on either side. The scan showed another river flowing through those hills, with yet another expansion of flatland on their west side. Beyond that, there is another mountain range of considerable altitude that we will have to cross in order to reach the western coastline. Unfortunately, there appears to be no way around it without at least tripling our transit time. By dusk, we had traveled a mere 10 kilometers, a much slower pace than Jack had hoped. Hopefully, as time passes, we will become stronger, and we will make up for lost time. What neither of us had anticipated are the numerous aches and pains associated with cross-country backpacking. As I write this entry, my muscle cramps and aching joints are so severe that the analgesics we both took more than an hour ago have provided little to no relief. I suspect it will take me some time to find sleep this night, but when I do, it shall be most deep. Day 8. Day 2 of our journey again found us trudging through the tall grass of the plains. Other than a few dozen varieties of annoying insects and the warmer climate of the lowlands, our travels thus far have been uneventful. Surprisingly, the hiking itself has been nearly as therapeutic as the painkillers we took last night. In the afternoon, we spotted a large short-haired animal hiding in the grass along our course. After observing the animal from behind a large rock, we determined that it was an herbivore, thanks to some useful information from the survival guide on Jack's data pad. This evening we pitched camp beside a small stream. As we dined on another entree from the dehydrated food supplies, we boiled a few liters of stream water to replenish our stock for the next few days. It is an extra burden to carry several days' worth of drinkable water on our backs, but we do not want to get dehydrated. Even though I now know that Jack is aware of my journal, I still prefer to write in private. Admittedly, I find myself avoiding discussing personal matters. Do not think for a moment that because I say it less,
that I do not miss you more and more with each passing day. The hour is quite late. I was awakened by a noise in the distance. It was a rustling sound in the distant bushes, similar to what I had heard the first night in our crash site camp. The noise did not wake Jack, so I took it upon myself to investigate. Imagine that. With my light, I searched the area in the direction of the noise, but found nothing. I suspect the sound was made by some curious animal, intrigued by our presence, yet too frightened by the campfire to approach for a closer inspection. I'm not sure what I would have done if I had seen the animal. If it were a large animal, one that I would have to defend myself against, would I be able to do so? At Jack's insistence, I have been wearing my sidearm, but I'm still afraid of using it. Nevertheless, I hope I would be brave enough to use it should the need arise. Fortunately, the rustling stopped rather quickly, no doubt because of my searchlight. And so I sit here, listening. It is quite astonishing how quiet it can actually get at night. Day 13. Today marks the completion of the first week of our journey. Each day has been much of the same. Eat, hike, and sleep. The hiking is getting easier as our bodies grow stronger, and the aches and pains at bedtime have also grown less severe. Surprisingly, this journey has been somewhat boring. Nothing but grass, streams, and rocks. We have counted countless species, both herbivore and carnivore, but they all keep their distance, and Jack is unwilling to pause for observation unless it is necessary for safety reasons. Although I am not looking forward to the uphill climb ahead of us, I will welcome the change in scenery. I found few geological samples of interest on this vast plain, and I am looking forward to the more varied sampling that the hills and eventual mountain will undoubtedly provide. It had been more than a week since Frank's near-death experience. His recovery had been better than expected, and Maria had been unable to find any side effects from the event. Frank returned to work, feeling better than ever. Despite Lynn's protests, Frank had continued his work on the radar set every evening after dinner. She did everything short of ordering him to stop wasting time on the hopeless repair effort. But Frank made it clear that his evenings were his own to do with as he pleased. Lynn had reminded him of his obligations to the mission, not to mention the rest of the team, and that he was not to let his work on the radar set interfere with his responsibilities. The weather had become hot and dry over the last few days, and they were consuming more water. Will had discovered that his bladder was nowhere near as large as Jack's, and he required frequent stops for relief, much to Jack's annoyance. The increased temperature also brought more insects. They slathered on some insect repellent, the smell of which, Will decided, was probably the main deterrent against the pesky winged organisms. It worked, to some extent, although many insects were unaffected by the stench and continued to bother them. Will wondered what made the original mission planners think that a lotion formulated to repel earth insects had any chance of working on an alien world. Suddenly, Will felt a sharp pinch at the back of his neck, instinctively slapping at what he suspected was another of the bothersome bugs. "Ouch!" Will exclaimed, as he slapped at his neck. "What's wrong?" Jack asked, without breaking stride or looking back. Jack was a determined man with a schedule to keep. "In my neck," Will explained, as he looked at his palm. There was a long, slender insect squished in his hand. The insect had red and yellow bands around a body nearly 3 centimeters long, with long, grayish wings protruding from its thorax. It was lying dead in Will's hand, surrounded by a small pool of bright red blood. Will shook the dead organism out of his hand, wiping the remains off on his pant leg.
"One of those bugs," he complained.
Will reached back up to his neck, feeling somewhat moist. Inspecting his hand again, he found some of his own blood was on it.
"I think it bit me."
"You all right?" Jack asked,
turning his head briefly to glance at Will.
"Yeah, I'm fine," Will assured him.
A few more hours and we should reach the base of the hills, Jack promised. We can pitch camp there for the night and start heading up the hill in the morning.
Sounds good, Will agreed.
He was tired and would welcome a good night's sleep.
Let's push on and get there, Will insisted. The sooner the better.
They continued their pace, a steady cadence of footfalls, marching closer and closer to the distant hills. Will realized that he was sweating more than usual, undoubtedly due to the heat. Then, Will's vision began to blur, but only for a moment. He stopped for a second and gulped down some water, figuring it was just a little dehydration. Replacing his canteen in its holster, Will trudged on, quickening his step to catch up to Jack. Then the wheezing began, mild at first, then growing more audible with each breath. He noticed that his gait had become somewhat staggered, uneven. Then it hit him, like a vice clamping around his chest, pushing all of the air out of his lungs.
Jack!
He gasped, but it was barely a whisper. Will fell forward, his eyes rolling back in his head, as he hit the ground face first in a cloud of dust. Jack heard a thud along with the rattling of gear from behind him, stopping in his tracks and spinning around to see what had happened. He froze for a second, shocked by the sight of Will collapsed face down in the grass, dust swirling around his unmoving body.
Will!
He hollered, but there was no response, no movement, and no sound, only settling dust. Jack ran back to him, unbuckling his pack and dropping it to the ground next to Will as he knelt down beside him.
Will!
He repeated, but he did not respond. He rolled Will onto his side, releasing the buckle on his fanny strap and sliding the pack off his back before rolling him over. Will was pale and sweaty, gasping for air in little sucking motions, his lips puckering up like a fish. With each breath, a sickening wheezing sound emanated from Will's pursed mouth. Jack's mind was spinning. His first instinct was to holler for help, but there was no one else around.
Shit!
Then his training came to him. He tilted Will's head back to open his airway. It seemed to help, but only a little. Feeling for Will's carotid artery on the side of his neck, he checked for a pulse. It was there, but it was weak and rapid. Jack ran through the different causes of difficulty breathing he had learned about in his emergency medical training. The term anaphylaxis stuck in his head. Jack reached for his backpack, tearing it open and pulling out the med kit. His medical training had been brief, concentrating on the necessary skills to implement treatment rather than dedicating limited training time building a knowledge base. He pulled out the diagnosis flip card chart, thumbing through it until he found the section on respiratory emergencies. Scanning the treatment for anaphylaxis, the memory was coming back to him. A. Airway did that, he spoke aloud. B. Breathing. C. Circulation, Jack read further, then ripped open the medication pouch, pulling out a vial of epinephrine and loading it into the pneumoject device. He pulled the plunger back, drawing the medicine into the administration chamber, then twisted the locking hub and rammed the plunger back down, pressurizing the device. He dialed up the subcutaneous setting and pulled up the right sleeve of Will's shirt. Pressing the injection head of the pneumoject device against Will's right deltoid, Jack depressed the trigger. The device hissed briefly as the compressed air in the chamber forced the epinephrine out of the injection head, piercing Will's skin. The shot forced the medicine into the subcutaneous tissue, where it would be carried through Will's circulatory system from the capillary beds under the skin. He quickly reloaded the pneumoject with the next appropriate medication, resetting the injection depth to intramuscular as indicated, and repeated the process. The next step was to administer oxygen, which they did not have. Jack watched impatiently as Will's respirations became less labored.
That's it, buddy.
Color was also returning to his face. Jack knew the treatment he had administered was working, but it was only emergency treatment, and Will might require more long-term care. He broke out the emergency medical guide on his data pad, calling up the medical section. The database had been designed with full knowledge of the medical supplies contained in their med kits. The database thoroughly covered anaphylaxis, indicating at least 12 hours of monitored rest, with possible repeat dosing of the meds he had given thus far. Jack checked his med kit.
He had 3 more vials of the 2 primary medications for anaphylaxis. Will's med kit was identical to Jack's, so he should have more than enough medication to get Will through the crisis. Unfortunately, the treatment protocols were based on allergic reactions to earth, conditions, insects, and allergens. And this was a bite by an alien insect on an alien world. Jack tried not to think about it, concentrating only on the task at hand. If there was a complication, he would deal with it as best he could. It had been nearly 5 minutes since he gave Will the meds. Will's breathing was almost back to normal, as was his complexion. But he was still unresponsive. His pulse was stronger now as well, and down to a normal rate. There was nothing to do but wait, and keep a close eye on Will's condition. Jack decided to pitch camp. They wouldn't be traveling any further today, and probably not the next day. He was not a religious man at heart. Very few of them were. Organized religion was not allowed in their society, although one could still practice whatever belief system they chose to in private. As a result, religion as a whole had given way to an overall moral and ethical code accepted throughout the colonists. However, that night, over a lonely meal, Jack found himself praying to any god who might exist for Will to survive. Long after the others had gone to bed, Lynn was still sitting at the wardroom table, picking at her dinner, deep in thought.
"A little late for dinner, isn't it?" Maria commented, as she entered the room after finishing up some late-night work in the med lab.
"Huh? What's the matter? Not hungry?" Maria asked, sitting down across from her and noticing the full plate.
"Oh, I guess I'm just a little preoccupied," she admitted.
"Want to talk about it?" she offered, going into counselor mode.
"Not really,"
Lynn resisted. As easy as Maria was to talk with, she still wasn't comfortable discussing command problems with anyone but Frank.
"It's about Frank, isn't it?" Maria surmised.
Lynn picked at her food another moment, then pushed it away.
"I just don't know what to say to him," she finally admitted. "He's obsessed with the belief that Jack and Will are still out there somewhere, waiting for us to rescue them."
"And you don't share his belief?" It was more of a statement than a question.
"Not really."
"But you admit that it's a possibility, however remote?" Lynn thought about it for a moment.
"Yes, I admit that it is possible. Anything is possible."
"And that bothers you?"
"Of course it bothers me." "Let me ask you a hypothetical question, then. If you knew that they were still alive, would you be able to do anything about it?"
"I don't know, maybe."
"Like what?"
"Organize a search team. Try to locate the escape pod's transponder signal."
"And where would you start looking?"
"Along its probable entry trajectory, of course."
"And where would that likely put them?" Maria asked. "Close to us?"
"Probably not," Lynn decided. Somehow, Maria had gotten her mind off her problem with Frank and set it to work on a problem that she could solve.
"Why do you think that?"
"We came out of interface considerably past our target. But we had the ability to turn around. The escape pod didn't. They would have been forced to land wherever their trajectory took them, and that would put them considerably downrange of us."
"So you would send us out on a cross-country hike that could take weeks, maybe even months to find them, if we could find them?"
"Well, not at first, no. We would have to secure our site, ensure our own survival, and determine the probability of our own survival on such a journey. I mean, we couldn't just set out cross-country on a whim. That would be suicide."
"Exactly. And that's if you knew they were alive. You don't even suspect that they made it out alive before the Icarus came apart."
Maria was silent for a moment, letting the concept sink in.
"Do you see what I'm getting at here?"
"Yes," she admitted, a little embarrassed that it had taken her so long to realize it in the first place.
"Part of you knows that you're right," Maria continued. "But the other part wants to join Frank and go storming off in search of them.
in your case, logic continues to win the argument. You know we still have a mission to complete, despite our being stranded here. In fact, our inability to survey the other two planets makes our thorough survey of this planet even more imperative.
I know, Lynn assured her.
Command is not an easy task, and I'll admit that it's not really fair that it fell on your shoulders, but it did, Lynn. And it's not only our lives that are depending upon you, it's quite possibly the lives of everyone else on board the Daedalus as well. And those are the lives of our families.
Maria leaned back in her chair. It was a lot to throw at such a young woman.
It can't be easy to abandon the lives of a few to save the lives of many. But you're not the first person in history who has had to make such a decision.
Lynn took in a deep breath, letting it out in a long sigh.
I just wish Frank would see it that way.
He does. I'm sure of it. Deep down inside, he knows you're right. He just feels guilty, like he could have done something else. Frank will work through it, sooner or later. He's a reasonable man. Just give him some time.
I have given him time. The rest of us are already beginning to pick up his slack. He's driving a wedge between us.
Do you want me to speak with him?
No, I should, she objected.
Nothing personal, Lynn, but he would probably take it better from me.
This was no surprise to her. Despite Maria's repeated assurances that her young age had little bearing on how well the crew accepted her as their leader, she knew it was still a factor. But she had no desire to confront Frank at this particular time.
Of course, she agreed, trying to conceal how much it bothered her.
Now get some sleep, Maria instructed, picking up her nearly full plate of uneaten food. I'll save this for Mac. I have no doubt he'll be happy to finish it for you.
Thanks,
Lynn smiled as she rose from the table. Sleep sounded awfully good to her right now.